This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopian News. We're about to talk to Karen Barth Menzies, who's an attorney with Baum Hedlund here in Los Angeles. She's going to talk to us about a number of developments in some lawsuits about the antidepressive drug Paxil. Welcome to Utopian News.
Thanks, Mark.
Why don't we start sort of on the context level? The federal government is divided into three parts. There's the federal, there's the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judiciary. And it's my view that the executive branch is controlled by the drug companies, that the legislative branch is controlled by the drug companies, but the judiciary, they haven't gotten to them yet because it's a little harder, and that's where people like you, who are trial lawyers, come in to try to get redress for people who have been damaged by corporate behavior. How fair a characterization of the situation would you say that is?
Well, I think that's a very fair characterization, except for that the judiciary branch is getting very dangerously encroached upon by the regulators and the drug companies in their efforts to try to control the judiciary as well.
In fact, as we're going to see a little later when we talk about it in detail, the FDA, which is a branch of the executive branch, has made some efforts that seem ludicrous to some and that ultimately failed to impose their particular view on whether this case ought to go forward at all.
Absolutely. They've taken the unprecedented move within the last year and a half of filing briefs in favor of the drug companies and against consumers in the litigation.
In case anyone missed it, this would be the same FDA that's trying to scare everyone into away from buying Canadian drugs that are identical to American sold drugs, except that they cost 50 or 80% less.
That's correct.
Okay. Why don't we move now to the biochemistry of this? We're going to be talking about selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. What is one of those, and why does it matter?
An SSRI is a class of antidepressants. They started off with Prozac. The most well-known ones that followed have been Zoloft and Paxil. They are designed, theoretically anyway, to block the serotonin when it's taken, and that is supposed to help a person feel better. They refer to it as a chemical imbalance. However, that is actually a theory created by marketing departments and not necessarily scientifically proven.
I certainly see it on those Zoloft commercials with that little teardrop who's unhappy, and then because of his chemical imbalance, or her, I can't tell, imbalance, and then they take Zoloft and everybody's happy.
That's the Zoloft blob, yes.
Right.
You know, it's unfortunate because they characterize it as if there's a scientific proof that somebody can be chemically balanced or has a chemical imbalance, and there is no proof of that. It's just a way to characterize it. They really have no idea on how to make somebody, quote-unquote, chemically balanced.
So, in fact, it's the triumph of marketing over science.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, this lawsuit that we're going to talk about has to do with Paxil and not with Zoloft or Prozac. Is Paxil somehow a different kind or a different variety of selective of SSRI so that it's had all these bad effects, or have the other one, have you just not gotten around to looking into those other two yet?
Actually, no. We do litigation on all three of these and as well as some of the others, but I think what you want to focus on is that SSRIs generally all have the problem of suicidality, causing suicidal ideation and violence when you first start taking it. This occurs in some people. Then you also have a problem with addiction and withdrawal symptoms. The drug companies like to refer to them as discontinuation symptoms, but they're the same type of symptoms somebody feels when they're physiologically addicted to a medication. And Paxil has a particularly bad problem with withdrawal and addiction because it has a short half-life, so it comes out of your body much quicker than an SSRI like Prozac. And then one note there is that Zoloft is perceived by many as not having that same problem with withdrawal, but it absolutely does.
Now, are you saying that part of Paxil's problem is because it metabolizes faster and therefore the blood serum level of the drug cuts off more sharply?
Yeah, that's kind of a way to describe it. I think the easiest way to think of it is that when you take your medication, it gets metabolized quicker and it leaves your body faster. So there's a more of an abrupt reaction from your body when it's stopped. If you need to taper off of it when you stop taking it, unfortunately, even when you taper off of it, however, you may still suffer the very severe withdrawal symptoms like the electric zaps or severe nausea or dizziness.
Okay. Now, is the mechanism of this addiction withdrawal syndrome well understood? Is it researched? Are there clear explanations of how it works?
Not really. There, unfortunately, it hasn't been studied well enough, even though the drug companies, in particular GlaxoSmithKline, has known about it as being a very significant problem for a very long time, even into the early or mid-80s before approval. They have not specifically studied it. However, they only until the late 90s did they start paying attention to what was happening to their patients in the clinical trials after they were finished with the portion of the trial where they take the medication. They didn't even monitor the people when they were finished taking the medication to see what was happening to them, if they were suffering any withdrawal, until, like I said, it was raised as a very serious concern in the late 90s.
Now, was that because they didn't have a budget to follow them up, or they didn't want to know, or they just didn't, it just didn't occur to them that there might be any addiction withdrawal problems with the drugs that no one had ever seen before in the history of the world, and they weren't sure what they did even when they were being taken?
Well, I wish I could be that optimistic, but from what I've seen in the internal documents, there's clear evidence that they have known about a very serious withdrawal problem for a very long time, way before the late 90s when they started looking at it.
Okay.
They didn't want to look at it and only started looking at it when they got pressure to do so.
Presumably people called up and said, I was just in your trial and now I'm going crazy. What can you do for me?
Well, you know, unfortunately, that isn't necessarily the way it plays out. What happens is that the people, when they're suffering the withdrawal symptoms, really have no idea necessarily that that's what they're, that it was caused by their medication, unless and until they take the drug again and all of a sudden their symptoms dissipate.
Right.
And then even when they go to their medical professionals, their healthcare providers and doctors, complaining of these symptoms, the doctors don't put two and two together because they haven't been warned about these potential side effects.
Okay. Tell us what the involvement of your firm, Baum Hedlund, is in this case, and if you want, just a little bit of background in terms of the firm and its interest or involvement in previous related medical cases.
Okay. Yeah, we have been specializing in SSRI litigation for about 12 years now, and have handled the suicide cases as well as the withdrawal cases for the medications we talked about, Paxil, Zoloft, Prozac, and others, Luvox, Effexor. So we've seen the development of the science over the past 12 years and the acknowledgement or lack thereof by the FDA of these issues. And so we've been involved with the regulatory process as well as the industry and the science as part of our litigation efforts.
Okay. And how did you come to be the lead law firm in this case that we're going to talk about now?
I think it's purely experience. Having been involved with it for so long, we have found the experts, the scientific experts that are willing to take a strong stance against the drug companies. There are very few out there. And so we've put together a stable of experts as well as a huge library of documents related to each one of these medications. And so we have just the experience and ability to take on the drug companies with the evidence that we have.
Now, just focusing on that problem with the experts a little bit, the point is, of course, that experts are loath to testify against a drug company because most of their funding as scientists comes from the drug companies, and if they do that, they're going to be taken off the list.
That's correct, and unfortunately, what's considered science out there now and what I think is starting to be exposed is, in reality, is a lot of ghostwriting being done on those scientific articles that they're drafted by the drug companies, and then they get an industry leader that they are friendly with to put their name on it, and then it appears as legitimate science, but it's very questionable.
Last week, the White House put out a press release with actors pretending to be reporters, talking about drug policy in the new Medicare bill.
Yep.
What is multi-district litigation?
Multi-district litigation is just simply, or referred to as MDLs,
right.
Is simply occurs when there's numerous cases that are similar, with similar allegations, filed in various different courts around the country, and these are in federal courts. So the judicial panel determines that, you know, why should I have a whole bunch of different federal judges deciding these same issues, so why don't we consolidate them at least for pretrial so that we have one judge who is addressing these issues rather than a whole bunch having duplicative efforts.
Okay, tell us about what happened in December, what happened just recently to set this up.
In the Paxil withdrawal cases, we had us and some other attorneys had filed cases around the country. I think around between 25 and 30 were going forward in that many different states.
Did that involve multiple people in each case?
Yeah, our cases we have been filing as mass joinder cases, and all that refers to is that you'll have anywhere between 20 to over 100 plaintiffs who file a case together because they're all making the same claims and based on the same facts and allegations.
What's the difference between a mass joinder and a class action case?
The fundamental difference is in a class action, you have one or two or a handful of plaintiffs named in the class action, and they are going forward on a representative basis, and that just means that you're not requiring all the other class members who fit under the class definition to file their own lawsuit. They're allowing the class representatives to file it and litigate it on their behalf.
And in a mass joinder,
you actually name all of those plaintiffs.
And apparently, from some of the reading I did, your request to do a class action suit was turned down, but your request to do a mass joinder case was accepted. Is that what happened?
To a degree, the class action, we proposed that first, which is a procedural method that, you know, we said that this is probably the most efficient way for the courts to address this issue because there are so many people who are having problems with it. They could really flood the court system. The judge decided that the issues were too diverse and it would be too complicated to do it on a representative basis, so in response to that, we said, okay, you know, we'll go ahead and file everybody individually. We can do that. We don't have to seek certification like you do for a class to file those. So it's not that we need approval to file a mass joinder. It's just an alternative method.
Okay. So is everyone making this the same claims and asking for the same relief, or do people's claims vary according to their situation?
The claims are the same. The causes of actions and the allegations against the drug company are the same. The damages do differ. It depends on the individual circumstances. Some people have suffered more damage than others.
So essentially there'd be a sliding scale for different kinds of damage that could be suffered, and people who are in each category would be compensated accordingly.
That's correct.
Okay. Tell us who's... Now, I'm not sure. Are they Smith, Klein, Beecham? Are they Glaxo? Who are these people who make Paxil?
It was originally Smith, Klein, Beecham, and then Glaxo Welcome.
Right.
They merged with Smith, Klein, Beecham. So now they're commonly referred to here as GSK. Like, you can find them on the website as GSK.com.
All right, GSK.
However, SKB, or Smith, Klein, Beecham, they are the dominant portion of the company related to Paxil because they were the originators of it, and Smith, Klein, Beecham is a company out of the United Kingdom. It's an English company.
Okay, so Smith, Klein, Beecham still exists, really makes Paxil, but GlaxoSmithKline owns SKB now.
Correct. I mean, I think corporate-wise they don't necessarily still exist, but the framework and the location
right.
in the UK for SKB is all still there, yes.
Right. Who's going to write the check if a check has to be written?
It would. There's Smith, Klein, Beecham doing business as GlaxoSmithKline, so they're basically one and the same.
Okay. And what other drugs do they make besides Paxil, just so that our listeners will have some idea about their ubiquity?
They do Wellbutrin. They do a lot of... they do some allergy medicines. They do some cough medicine, over-the-counter type medications.
Right. Where do they stand in the hierarchy of really big drug companies?
Oh, really, really big. I would say they are probably in the top three.
Okay. Do you know, and can you tell us how much money that they've made so far selling Paxil?
I can't tell you on an aggregate. I can give you a figure from, I think it was 2002, they made $2.5 billion.
Now, is that revenue or profit? Or?
I think that's...
Revenue.
Yeah.
How much they sold? They sold $2.5 billion worth
of
the drug. So this is a pretty widespread drug then,
well,
isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You know, Mark, I think anybody who's reading or listening to this probably either has been on it or knows somebody who's been on Paxil.
Right. It's like one or 2 degrees of separation.
Absolutely.
Between any person and Paxil.
Yeah. I mean, you start talking about it and people start coming out of the woodwork. And anytime I mention it or it comes up, people are coming to me saying, having more questions. You know, I was on it and I suffered this, or my friend went on it. And, you know, do you know anything about this? I mean, it really is, they've been extremely successful in their marketing.
So, well, you're not a physician. You end up playing one at cocktail parties because people want to know everything about the drug from you, presumably, by now.
Which you'll laugh because actually that includes doctors. I've even been contacted by doctors asking me about what the risks are related to this
okay.
drug.
We're gonna talk about that. Or let's rush ahead to one particular part. If it's so dangerous, as you're alleging here, why is it allowed to be sold at all?
Well, I think what the key of the lawsuits is trying to get at is that the doctors have been failed to warn about the side effects and risks related to the drug. So part of the duty of the drug company is to inform doctors so that they know not only the good but also the bad. And what they're not telling them is the bad. They're neutralizing it, downplaying it, avoiding it, hiding it. And so it's really the doctor's determination on whether their particular patient, given that they know all the risks and they know all the benefits, then it's the doctor who determines whether this drug would be appropriate for a particular patient. Some patients are in such a bad state. For example, the antidepressants, the SSRIs themselves, were originally designed for individuals with clinical depression, major depression. These are people who are forced to stay in clinics because their depression is so bad.
Right.
And so in those contexts, you might say that, well, even though we've got these risks here, the benefit may outweigh it. They may help this person, so I'm going to go ahead and prescribe it. Unfortunately, without telling the doctors all about what the risks are, doctors have been much more willing to prescribe it to anyone and everyone for any kind of an ailment. I've seen it, you know, for you name it, headaches, stomach aches. I just sort of felt out of sorts. They're giving it away.
Like that little blob who feels depressed.
Yeah, just a little sad. I'm not feeling so good today, so let me take this psychotropic medication.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Peter Kramer, who I interviewed twice in the 90s, was talking about all these issues then. Does his work figure into this at all, or was he seen as a big friend of, I think Lilly makes Prozac, and he was making it clear that he didn't work for Lilly. Has his work and his statements about these SSRIs have any impact on the situation today?
Well, absolutely. I think that there's a lot of doctors out there that don't necessarily work specifically for the drug company, but their research is funded by it, or their trials are funded by it. So you tend to have doctors who are used by the drug companies to champion their causes.
Right. Now, these are the same doctors who are referred to at the end of all of these sort of vague drug commercials on television that say, ask your doctor.
That's correct. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because John Mann is a doctor that you're going to see a lot more of and that we've been seeing a lot of. He's out of Columbia in New York, and he's been used by the FDA as one of the individuals who's supposed to be objective in looking at the risks related to SSRIs, but at the same time, he's also the one who's interviewed by the media on behalf of the drug companies, and he's used as an expert against us, the consumers, in the litigation. So you really, you know, they have the PhD after their name, but you really have to look and see where their interests lie.
I think what would be ideal would be for those actors who played the reporters in the White House commercials to interview this doctor. They'd have a completely falsified experience.
Yeah.
How important? So, tell me how the people made themselves known to you, or you to them, so that you could aggregate as many as you have, and tell me how many you've aggregated into your case.
It's actually an interesting kind of little side story.
Sure.
We've been doing the suicide cases, like I said. We were part of the original MDL for the Prozac cases, and so known as one of the few firms in the area that has successfully litigated the SSRI cases. And so people would associate our name with the drug litigation related to Paxil or Prozac or Zoloft. And so as part of the people contacting us, we kept getting more individuals contacting us about and complaining of problems with withdrawal and addiction.
Right. And because you were known that you dealt with the suicide or suicide attempt cases.
And that's correct.
And therefore, they could sort of say, well, maybe you could deal with addiction and withdrawal as well.
Yeah, and so what you're dealing with now, we weren't able to take them on at first because, you know, we can only do so much. There's a few of us. But
right.
So they were personal injury cases, and, you know, each of these cases can cost between, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars to litigate an individual case. So we couldn't afford to take on personal injury cases. But there were so many that kept piling up, and we kept seeing this huge need for help for these people. We tried to find other lawyers to do them as PI cases, but they couldn't and wouldn't. And then also at the same time, we're doing investigation and seeing all the internal documents from the drug companies and realizing that there is just a ton of evidence against these drug companies about the withdrawal issue and how they knew about it and what they did to hide it. So we finally said, well, we've got to do something. And so that's how we came up with the approach of joining a bunch of plaintiffs together and trying to see if we can move the case forward, justify the cost of doing that, if we're doing it on a group-wide basis.
Because essentially there are economies of scale.
Absolutely.
With a larger number of plaintiffs.
That's right.
This sounds just remarkably like the cigarette companies' science research and propaganda and lies about tobacco. Over 40 or 50 years, or 100 or 60 or 70 years.
Yeah, and over time, people start to realize what was known earlier by the manufacturers, and that the realization that the marketing of the medication or in tobacco, whatever, people didn't used to think it was addictive, and over time they started to see that it was because so many people were on it.
In fact, it's an addictive drug that causes terrible withdrawal symptoms, nicotine.
Yeah.
But not only did they not say that, they went out of their way to hide that fact.
That's correct.
Now, was that essentially what happened with Paxil also?
Yep.
All right. Well, how important was it? I mean, it's obvious, but answer it anyway. How important was it in achieving their sales levels, like you said, in 2002, $2.5 billion? But how important to that was the hiding of the downside of the drug, of its addictive and withdrawal problems?
Extremely important. And the reason for that is so that they can get a market share above the other SSRIs. Now, they marketed Paxil with its short half-life as a benefit over the other SSRIs like Prozac or Zoloft, and more importantly over the benzodiazepines. Now, these are Valium and Xanax, and these are the medications that right around the late early to mid-90s it started coming out that those drugs are addictive.
Right.
So GlaxoSmithKline went in with their representatives and said, hey, you know, don't worry about the benzos. You don't have to prescribe those anymore. We have something even better, prescribing Paxil, because Paxil doesn't cause addiction. It doesn't cause those same withdrawal effects.
What was the perceived or stated benefit of it being shorter acting?
The benefit that they marketed that for is that if a person's on the medication and it's not working for them, they can be switched to another medication without having to wait for it to leave the body. So you don't have as long of a washout period as what it's
for a couple of days or weeks? Or
a couple of days. It's 28 hours, I believe, is the half-life.
But in fact, so ironically then, the very fact they were using as the selling point was intimately linked to the problem.
Absolutely. And we have the evidence and have shown it in some of the courts, and that was one of the pieces of evidence that we used in getting the judge in the federal court to get the ads that it's not habit-forming off the air.
Okay. Say more about that and about their advertising now and how much of it has been changed due to your work.
Well, I think that that many people are familiar with seeing that old advertisement where it said that Paxil is non-habit-forming.
Right.
We took direct steps with the judge even before we were at the stage of merits in the case, which is a difficult standard to reach, but without getting too legal, we provided the court with evidence showing that there is a very serious problem with withdrawal and addiction, and to market it as non-habit-forming relays the opposite message. And as long as they're allowed to continue to do that, you're going to continue to have people taking it who are going to become addicted to it, relying on that false advertising.
Okay. And so what was the decision where to take that off?
It was here in the Central District in Los Angeles, and the judge ruled in our favor.
When was that?
That was in August of 2002.
Right.
Now we play into what we started talking about, and that was within 2 days of that ruling, the FDA came in with a motion to intervene into the case and present the court with their argument on why the drug companies should be able to keep that ad on the air.
And what was the FDA/drug company argument?
Is that the judge doesn't have a right to review these ads to determine if they're false and misleading. Instead, that if the FDA says those ads are okay, the buck stops there.
And what happened with that claim of the FDA?
The judge rejected their legal arguments completely. She said that it defies even common sense, that her role as a judicial officer is to review the evidence and make the determinations on these claims.
They had in fact said that their decision that a drug is okay preempts anybody's bringing a personal injury suit against the drug company. Isn't that what they were saying?
Basically, yes. They're coming in to say that if it's okay with the FDA, then no judiciary can come in and tell us it's not okay.
Which is a fundamental rejection of what I was talking about at the very beginning here, about the separation of powers, where they were essentially saying the judiciary ought to have no power.
You got it.
In cases involving the executive branch.
You got it. Let me finish real quick, though,
Mark. Please.
Just so you know, the ultimate result, however, of the FDA coming in was, even though she rejected their legal arguments, she did withdraw her order. So she permitted them, if they wanted to keep the ad on the air, she withdrew her order mandating that they take it off. However, at the same time, they had already told her that they had taken it off the air. So, you know, it's not real clear what her decision was based upon.
Right.
But it did have the effect of her withdrawing that injunctive order.
So there is no longer that injunctive order. They could put it back up tomorrow if they wanted to.
They could, and if they did, they would be faced with some serious motions on our part.
Okay. What possible defense can the makers of Paxil make to the data and arguments that you're presenting?
Oh, it's their consistent defense that they have had in all the SSRI litigation, and that is that they blame the patient. Yeah, they do. They just say that, you know, these people are crazy anyway, or don't you see they're already screwed up mentally, that's why they're on the drug, and it's not our drug, it's their personal problems. And
it's personal responsibility.
Absolutely.
Kind of like that, the fat food industry passing a rule that says you can't sue people if you get fat from eating fat food that you've been urged on television, radio, television, and in the store to buy.
Well, you know, it's even more exacerbated because while they really play up the problems with mental health in our society, and they talk about the fact that there are so many individuals who are afraid to come out to their doctors and admit to having problems with mental health issues. But then if they do and they take a medication and then they suffer with symptoms from this medication, then the drug company then turns around and says, oh, well, you were so crazy or you were so screwed up mentally that all of your symptoms that you claim are related to our drug were really caused by all of you and your personal problems.
So on the one side, they're trying to argue that the executive branch's word should be final. On the other hand, they're arguing that individuals have no standing to complain about anything that's done to them by a psychotropic drug because they wouldn't have taken it if they weren't the kind of people who had no right to complain about anything anyway.
Well, to a degree, it's not quite as far as what you're saying there.
Okay.
What they try to do is just find what they call an alternative cause.
Right.
So if I told you that when somebody abruptly stops Paxil, even when they taper Paxil,
right,
they have very severe mood swings, they have very serious problems with dizziness and headaches.
Right.
What they will do is say, well, no, those headaches you're complaining about or those mood swings you're talking about, you suffered those before, that was caused by some work-related injury you had, or that must be because your family has a history of mental health problems, and so it's just, you know, your mental health problems relapsing. And actually, that was one of the ways they addressed the withdrawal, or hid the withdrawal issue with the FDA early on.
When they said if people get withdrawal symptoms, it's just because they stopped taking the drug, and therefore their old symptoms returned.
Exactly, and that's referred to as relapse.
But if, let's say you're a person who's totally depressed, and you've sat around for years being totally depressed, mm-hmm. and you haven't had headaches, and you haven't had nausea, and you haven't been going crazy, you've just been depressed, and you take the drug, and then you stop taking it, and you don't get depressed again, but you get agitated and nauseous and irritated and have terrible headaches.
And you have electric zaps.
And you have electric zaps.
That you've never had before.
That you've never had before. Can anyone with a straight face then say that this is a relapse to the old symptoms when they're not the old symptoms? And presumably a lot of people under psychiatric care have been pretty well documented, so there are reams and reams of pieces of paper and computer files that say what the symptoms have been pre-drug.
Oh,
they still do that?
Oh, absolutely. They pay their experts a lot of money to do it.
Okay. You make three specific allegations in one of the versions of the suit that I read, and the first was no informed consent. How does informed consent relate to what you've been talking about the cover-up of the true facts about the drug?
That goes back to a person can't make informed consent, or their doctors cannot make an informed consent for their patients if they're not informed. And when we say informed, they should be told both about the benefits but also about the risk.
And that's pretty well established in the informed consent literature, right? That
correct.
You can't just tell them the good things. You got to tell them the bad things.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay. And then you also complain about the Paxil has caused a material and substantial number of people who take it to experience serious and unexpected withdrawal reactions. This is your claim that not taking it causes these problems.
Correct.
Okay. And
so when people took the medication, they didn't know that they could, they thought they could just stop taking it, and so did their doctors, without any ramifications. And there are other medications on the market that they could take where they wouldn't have such difficult problems with withdrawal. But the way Paxil was marketed, it covered that all up.
Okay. And the third point was that it says here, defendants have known for years the distinct character distinct characteristics of Paxil, which make it prone to cause withdrawal symptoms after its use is reduced or discontinued.
That's correct, and that's where you get into the realm of fraudulent representations and misrepresentations as well as punitive damages. They've known about it for a very long time, and instead of informing everybody, they covered it up and instead made sure that they made as much money on the drug as possible.
Now, were you able to get access to all the documents that established those facts?
And we're still getting it, yes. We've got just a ton of documents already, but we're still getting more and more. There's just a great deal of evidence, and you really have to sift through a lot of paperwork to establish everything, and that's part of why the cost of litigation is so high, but we're finding some very valuable evidence showing, like I said, knowledge and cover-up for many, many years.
And there was there a subpoena issued, or how is that working?
Unfortunately, it goes through a protective order. That's very common in the industry, that in order to get internal documents, which are considered quote-unquote confidential, at least in the industry, that we sign a protective order so that we can see everything. And they still fight our ability to see everything, because they claim privilege on a lot of it. And so we also have to fight against their withholding documents they claim are privileged, which we don't believe are justifiably privileged.
This is kind of what Diebold did with its electronic voting system, and I'm trying to get some information out of the Pentagon, and I'm just starting the long, tedious trail into the data there. Obviously, the information that's developed internally to these organizations is their bread and butter, and they don't want to give it up.
They don't want to give it up, and then when you get to a point, you have to be extremely tenacious in the discovery efforts, motions to compel, and second and third and fourth efforts. And then when you do get documents, they love to give you the big paper storm where you have to, you know, go find a needle in the haystack.
It's passive aggressive.
Yeah.
You want this? Here are 100 boxes.
You
figure it out.
Exactly.
It's in there. A slightly more personal question, something about the fiduciary, moral, and psychological dimensions of your responsibility for the interests of so many people who have allegedly suffered so much at the hands of the defendants?
There's no going back. And I appreciate that question, because these are very difficult cases, not only because the cost and the time and the complexity of the science, but also because you are dealing with the difficulty of people who are suffering very serious mental health issues, and so you have to be able to like you said, you have to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff and show what was caused by the drug and what wasn't. But when you've seen the documents that we've seen and how these drugs were marketed and the fraud on the industry and on the medical profession in particular, like I said, there's no going back. I couldn't stop, because we need to expose this. It's really bad.
Okay. Have you specified monetary or injunctive relief that you're looking for?
No, we haven't.
Where in the process would that take place? After you won?
Yeah, well, I mean, it would be determined. The pleading requirements are particularly focus on they preclude you from being able to put in monetary amounts.
Right.
It's part of the procedural process. Then also, if there's a verdict, then that's when you see the money. If there's a settlement, you generally don't, in part because of, financial concerns for the both sides, the plaintiff and the defendant, as those, financial matters are generally private. So.
Okay. So does that mean even if you win, the settlement will be private?
The defendants definitely will approach that, will expect that, and depends on the particular situation. There are times where we've settled cases where we do need to keep them. I don't have a problem keeping the settlement amounts private, because it's a person's private financial
right.
information.
Right.
But the fact that it's a private settlement, the fact that it's settled, whether that's private or not, we've not agreed to keep that confidential.
Okay. Lay out, if you would, the next few steps. When are you going to court next? What's going to happen? What are the stages that are looming in front of you now?
Right. Well, we're actually having our first hearing in front of Judge Fowler, with the cases all being now consolidated as the MDL.
What's the name of this court that you're going to be in?
It's the Central District of Los Angeles. It's the federal court here in California.
Right.
And Judge Fowler, she's the judge that we have had over the last couple of years in litigating the cases that we had here in California. Now all the rest of the cases throughout the country have been brought into her courtroom, too. So this, like I said, will be the first time that we're all in front of her as a nationwide group of cases.
Right, in the same way, you're the go-to company about this. She's the go-to judge, apparently, because she learned all about it as doing California cases with you, presumably.
Well, yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that, too, because we actually, when we moved, we were the ones to request the judicial panel consolidate all the cases into one courthouse. Because, you know, the defendants had a divide-and-conquer strategy, and were trying to spread us out really thin. And so you had a lot of, and you also have the fear of conflicting decisions by various different judges on the same issues. So when we requested it of the judicial panel, GSK fought very hard against it. And we asked that it be all consolidated in front of Judge Bowser. They fought against that, too.
And did they make some specious argument about that?
Well, they said that if the cases are all put into one courtroom, that that'll cause proliferation, their way of saying that a whole bunch of other cases will be filed that may or may not be legitimate cases, but they'll just think, okay, now we all want to jump into the game.
Has that happened?
Not particularly. I mean, I know that there's other cases that are out there, but I don't think that it's, you know, a huge amount more than it was when we asked for the MDL.
Can you say how many plaintiffs you are arguing for?
Yeah, I think we're in the realm of about 4,000.
Okay. Republicans like to go out of their way to castigate and heap aspersions on trial lawyers.
they blame us for everything.
They blame you for everything. Now, here's your chance to speak out against that kind of attack and tell us why it matters that you be able to do what you're doing here.
There's one fundamental reason, and that is without the litigation, those internal documents that we get and that we can give to our experts will never see the light of day. And we're the only ones who can get those. The FDA can't even get them. They don't even have subpoena power. So if anybody really wants to find out what the dirt is on the case and really get truth out there, the only way to do it is through litigation.
So really there's having taken over the executive and legislative branches, there's nothing to stop the drug companies from doing absolutely everything they want unless they can be called to account in a court of law.
You got it, exactly.
And even then, as you said, they're going to bring as much as they can bear on that case. Who's the? They got one law firm? They got an internal law firm or outside firm? How's their defense taking shape?
Their main defense firm is King & Spalding out of Atlanta.
Right.
And then they also have a local counsel here and in Philadelphia called Drinker Biddle.
Right.
Drinker Biddle and Reese. And so that's their. But the lead counsel on the case is King & Spalding.
Okay. And okay.
These are attorneys extremely experienced in the pharmaceutical litigation. They do only defense on pharmaceutical cases, and there are common adversaries.
Is this David and Goliath? Are they much bigger than your firm?
Well, the firm's certainly quite a bit bigger. Absolutely. I mean, and they have just probably thousands of lawyers at their beck and call if they want to work on the cases.
Right.
So, yeah, it is to a degree, absolutely. It certainly, I feel that way, and I have a much more heightened sensitivity towards that feeling for my plaintiffs because, you know, they see through the course of this litigation, and I try to explain it to them gingerly, but they really see how badly they're attacked personally when they bring a lawsuit against this Goliath.
Right.
Like I said, their defense is to attack the patient and put them in the worst light possible. So what they do is they obtain medical records, educational, contact ex-boyfriends, ex-husbands, any kind of skeleton that they can dig out of a closet, even if it took place 20 years before you ever even took Paxil.
Right.
That's what they'll go for.
Before it was a gleam in the biochemist's eye.
Yeah, exactly.
Are they going to be, and that's what you're saying happens when an individual sues the drug company, mm-hmm, by him or herself. They concentrate on that, they make a victim out of the plaintiff. Who was already a victim, of course. They re-victimize the plaintiff. How is that going to be limited by having 4,000 plaintiffs? Are they going to just do that serially to everyone, or are they going to do it as a class? How can they make that argument now that there are 4,000 plaintiffs?
Well, they'll continue to do it. It won't stop them from doing it. That's their defense. What allows us to continue forward and have a heightened strength,
right,
is, in sheer numbers, is... you know, they have the most experienced attorneys with the best experts in the field who are willing to stand up and go to bat for them.
Or the best paid experts, anyway.
No, but I'm talking about
on your side.
The plaintiff's experts, yeah.
Right.
Because if they had, for example, if you have a law firm in some other part of the country that you know, a Paxil withdrawal victim comes through their door and they say, okay, I'll represent you. Well, they don't even necessarily know have the resources or know how to get in touch with the resources to effectively take on GlaxoSmithKline. And the most potent way to do that is with the most prominent, internationally prominent experts in the area of SSRIs, and that's what we have.
And you have those, and they presumably are making the argument that supports your case.
That's correct. Well, it depends. They review the individual's circumstances and evaluate whether or not they believe that the drug had caused their symptoms and which of the symptoms that they're complaining of were actually caused by the drug.
Right.
And then that's how they move forward.
Okay. I read also in some of your material that the company has put strong warnings about withdrawal and addiction on its packages in Europe,
yeah,
but not in the U.S. What's up with that?
Well, they've warned about Paxil withdrawal for years in the UK and in Spain, many of the European countries. They all get a warning, but apparently Americans don't deserve one, or unfortunately our FDA is not real effective in getting those types of warnings. They've also, as of December 2001, the FDA finally required there be a warning for Paxil related to the drug company's term discontinuation. And basically what it finally now says is that if your patient abruptly stops Paxil, they could suffer quote-unquote discontinuation symptoms, and they list some of the symptoms, not all, but they talk about electrical zaps. They call those sensations, and then the nausea, severe nausea and dizziness and vertigo and things like that. And then they say to the point that the doctor may be required to put the patient back on the drug and then slowly taper them off.
The use of the term it sounds like a wardrobe malfunction to call something a discontinuation symptom when it's withdrawal.
Yeah, well, discontinuation isn't even a medical term. The medical term for this reaction is withdrawal independent.
Right.
But and even in the European countries, they had gone to the regulators there when the regulators required them to warn about this, and said, we'll warn about it, but we want to use the term discontinuation. And the regulators over there said, no, that would be misleading. The medical term is withdrawal.
Right, okay. Is this fact that Europeans get the warning and Americans don't at all related to the fact that prescription drugs cost more in the United States than anywhere else, and why the FDA says it's going to prosecute people who try to buy their drugs in Canada?
Yeah, I think it goes right back to what you started with, the extraordinary power and influence that the drug companies have in our country.
Okay. Is this going to go in front of a jury or in front of that judge you mentioned or what?
Yeah, it will go in front of a jury, the compensatory claims. We also have false and misleading advertising claims, that those will be tried to the judge, but the claims of injuries will be tried to juries. Yeah.
So the decision about whether your argument that these symptoms were caused by stopping the drug versus the drug company's statement that it's because the people were mentally ill before they took them will be decided by those jurors, right? Not the judge?
That's correct.
Okay. Are there any particular things that you've learned that you're going to apply in talking to the jury to make the science as clear as possible?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we need to face, the reality we need to face in the is the common public perception of the value of these medications. Even the FDA recognizes that the efficacy related to the SSRIs, and that means, quote-unquote, are they effective, is marginal. And so during the approval process, they showed marginal effectiveness, but they were still approved. And so we have to really use the evidence that we have to illustrate to the jury the marketing, the successful marketing that was done with regard to these drugs, not just to sell them like with the TV ads or brochures, but also the way they give talks at medical schools, and they sponsor textbooks, and they really proliferate the scientific journal articles. That in every way they possibly can, we need to show how the marketing has penetrated everywhere and created this social perception that these drugs are quote unquote the wonder drugs, and we need to show evidence that that's not really the case, so that people realize that they don't fall into that usual reaction of blaming the patient. Well, they were kind of crazy anyway. Why were they taking the medication?
Of these two outcomes, which one do either of these outcomes seem to plausible to you? One, you win the case, and they pay a settlement, and then that's the end of it, and they carry on their merry ways. Or you win the case, and the public comes to realize that the marketing efforts are so predominant, and the desire for profit and control are so paramount in the operation of the drug companies that, oh, I don't know, they sweep. Will this case be settled by November?
Wow, that would be great. I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
No, I think it will be. We're just starting the MDL now. While we've done a great deal of work on the cases already because they've been around for a couple of years, so we aren't just starting for certain.
Right. Well, we'll be settled by 2008.
Yeah, I hope Yeah.
Or by the elections of 2006. So essentially, go ahead.
One of the things you look at too, Mark, is how and why they need to protect their drug. They're very aware of their patent life.
Right.
And that does, I think, have an effect on how and whether they litigate or resolve cases.
Do you know when the patent on this runs out?
Yeah, it ran out. It just ran out last year.
So what's their advantage in fighting anymore?
Well, they try to get the drug indicated, get more indications.
Meaning it can be prescribed for other things?
Right. And then also you still have the yes, I raced over that. That's correct on that. But you still also have, the public perception of the drug itself as, there's still, I want the real thing.
Right.
So even if you have non-generic. Correct.
So get the real Paxil, not some generic version.
Yeah, and so they want to continue the good perception they have of their medication, although it's just a bit harder to do once it's gone generic.
Now, I don't want to be even more cynical than I really am, but is it possible that, knowing, as you've said, they've known full well from the beginning about these dangers, that they would refuse to settle, continue to sell it, and if they're making $2.5 billion a year in income, in revenue, then, and they calculate, what are the lawyers costing them, what's a likely settlement going to cost them, and if the cost-benefit analysis comes out that they could sell it for a few more years, make a few more billion dollars, and come out ahead, even if a lot more people are, I don't want to use the word poisoned, but made addicted, could they do that? Would they do that?
That's called a business decision, and that's what they've been doing.
All right.
Absolutely.
You want to give us one or two cases generically or anecdotally and certainly anonymously about the plaintiffs and what's happened to them as they've gone through this, both before, during, after, and now?
Yeah, sure. I think that the people who see this or read this and wonder for their own purposes, one of the things that we see very commonly are patients who are suffering very severe withdrawal. They go to their healthcare professional and they're misdiagnosed or they're given a whole bunch of different tests, all those tests coming up negative because the healthcare providers aren't aware that this could be related to Paxil. And I think one of the most extreme cases that I've seen is a man down in Florida who had he was having trouble with the Paxil. He went into his doctor, and his doctor diagnosed him with a really very rare heart condition and put in a defibrillator heart monitor in his body to address that issue. And he comes to find out himself, he figures out on his own that he's continuing to have problems with these withdrawal symptoms and realizes it's the Paxil. So now he does a ton of research and finds that out on his own. Now he's got the trouble of trying to find a doctor who's willing to take on the liability of removing this pacemaker.
Right. No, is the doctor going to pass the responsibility back to the drug company for not telling him?
Well, the litigation's going on right now, so we'll see what's happening with that.
Okay. Go ahead.
Then you also have, I think the clearest examples are people who go in for, they really market heavily the OBGYNs, and they're main target is women in their mid-30s to mid-40s.
Right.
And so, a woman goes in and says, yeah, I've been kind of tired lately, and no history of mental depression, mental health issues at all, and they're given this medication, and they take the drug. It may or may not make them feel better. Sometimes it just makes them feel more agitated. That's what we talked about a little bit earlier.
Right.
But then when they decide, okay, I'm feeling pretty good, maybe this is 3 months later or 6 months later or even 2 years later, they get off. They try to stop taking the medication, and then they can't. And then now they're dealing with an addiction.
What do your statistics tell you about what percentage of people who take the drug end up addicted / having withdrawal symptoms?
Well, the numbers that we've seen, the occurrence rate, that's kind of what we call it,
right,
is that it could happen to any. I've seen numbers anywhere between 30%, 50%, up to even 83%. But GSK's numbers are well over half.
I'm sorry, their numbers are well over half?
Yeah.
Their own, oh, this is not their publicized numbers. This is their internal memos.
This is basically what you see is we've had experts look at the data related to the occurrence rate, you know, how many people when coming off of it would suffer this reaction.
Right.
And so, yeah, like I said, some of the data that we've seen from some of the trials indicates that it's, like I said, well over 50%.
So, in fact, when you're talking about the demographic there that's particularly targeted here, women in their mid to late 30s, presumably their own metabolism as well as the entire social structure which has influenced their positioning in life is what's causing this. And a change in a way, and in order to eliminate it or change it or improve it, it would be necessary to change everything. And it's not. It sounds like Mother's Little Helpers from 1963.
You got it exactly.
Okay. Well,
they can't give them Valium and Xanax anymore because now the benzos, it took them 10 years, FDA 10 years to figure out that that's addictive, by the way.
Maybe they'll learn that they have to change, as Rilke said, we must change our lives and not change our medication.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of it has to do with nutrition and and vitamins and exercise. There's actual scientific studies showing that exercise is better, some of the best
antidepressant,
for depression.
It makes endorphins.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a selective serotonin uptake inhibitor substitute.
Right, right.
Any last things you want to say? You want to gauge your chances of winning?
Well, we're not stopping, so.
Okay. Is there much that the general public can do after they listen to this and they're convinced that you're the side that should win? Is there? I mean, they can't write their congressman. They can't write the judge. Is there something they can do to show solidarity or to work in the same direction that you are through your litigation?
Yeah, absolutely. There's various things they can do. They can write congressmen. Another thing too, though, is on the FDA's website called the MedWatch program. If they've suffered their symptoms themselves from this or any medication, you can report that to the FDA. And the FDA may or may not do anything with it, but, the more people report it, the better.
Right.
And then the other thing I was going to say, too, just for their own personal purposes, be careful in blindly trusting your doctor and your drug companies because they, the doctors rely on what the drug companies tell them, and to drug companies, it's all a matter of profit.
As I like to say, they're not in it for their health.
No, they're not. Or yours. But I think that, like what I do, if I'm prescribed anything, I go on the internet, and instead of going to places like WebMD, those are all sponsored by drug companies, any of those types of internet sites will just give you the same stuff that is fed to the doctors. You want to go on the sites that look for side effects or the dangers and kind of search it that way just to get a general feel, because what I have more often than not are individuals who discovered somehow from a media article or somehow they discovered that what they were suffering from was actually their drug and not them. And then when they went on the internet to research it that way, they just got an overwhelming amount of information about that they wish they would have known before.
Right. Are you still taking more plaintiffs?
Yeah.
And I'm going to put a link to your company's your firm's website right below this, and people can go and visit and talk to you or sign up or whatever they want to do.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of information, scientific information on the litigation, to back up a lot of the stuff that we've talked about today. So just for informational purposes,
right.
Too.
Good. Thank you very much for talking to us. Good luck in the case. Maybe we'll check in, over the years to come as it goes forward and see what's happening.
Sounds great.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
All right, you're welcome.
Bye.